This is truly an inspiring time, and the meaning of the day is really capsulized. If you can think of various meanings coming out of sin, getting the leaven out, the do's and the don'ts, we were reminded it's not a ritual, and yet we do it all the time as if it were a ritual, but it's not just an empty occurrence, a ritual. If you were to really summarize it all, the why we do this, from God's standpoint, it was in that last song. It's all about freedom, brethren. What freedom really is. There is one account in the Bible, in the coming out of Egypt, that I started to focus on in preparing for this season, and I got stuck on it because I have the opportunity to speak to all these different churches, so I just kept focusing on this theme. So I'm going to give you a sermon. You've probably never heard a whole sermon on the pillar and the cloud. You ever heard a sermon on the pillar and the cloud? Let's go to Exodus 13. Starting in verse 17, we see this, as it were, the final escape from Egypt physically being set up by God, and then him giving a sign of his presence that has a unique position in the theology that is to come. It is verse 17 in chapter 13 of Exodus, came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go that God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. So into the days of unleavened bread, of course, they had plenty of territory to go this way, that way, or this way. And God led them not up right in the straight course to the promised land in the way of the Philistines, what would be known as Gaza, the borderline with Gaza today, although that was near. Now, why didn't God take the short route? Because he hadn't decided that the people couldn't go in the land pretty much right away yet, because they hadn't really made a big botch of their calling quite yet. So it wasn't in God's mind to necessarily have them wander around with his direction, of course, for 40 years at this point. So why didn't he lead them to the straight way into the promised land? Well, it says, for God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. Oh, there was more trouble coming. God wasn't through with the Egyptians completely, and so he knew the mentality inside the children of Israel pretty well, and there's going to be more trouble. There's going to be another battle. And he knew that when they saw trouble that they would want to return to Egypt. I wonder why. Well, we'll see a little bit of their mentality. So God led the people round about the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. So he got them stuck against this body of water instead of taking them in this bridge of land where they could pretty much go straight away into the promised land. And the reason was God knew their internal psychology, how these people thought and how they would react to a trial like another war or a war. God knows how people think before they understand anything about God. And so it's they went up out of the land of Egypt in orderly ranks, and Moses, of course, took the bones of Joseph because this was a historic event. There had been a prophecy hundreds of years before that they were going to leave the land of Egypt and that they were going to have an opportunity to go to the promised land. This had been set up, but not that these people remembered much about anything. They had for generations been slaves. And so they took their journey from Succoth around the border of Goshen, where they were in this Nile's Delta area, and camped at Etham at the edge of the wilderness. Now we see the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud. So God was in there inside a pillar of cloud to lead the way. And then at night in a pillar of fire to give them light so as to go by day and night. So all of a sudden, as they're leaving, this pillar occurs and they look up in the daytime and there's this cloud that spreads out, but there's a pillar that goes all the way down to the ground, kind of like a big tornado. I don't know if one of those class fives or a short one, you know, but one of those tornado-like sort of things. It was obviously pretty impressive. Other places in the Old Testament, it says it gave them a shadow. It was overshadowed them. So apparently, this gave them shade. It's pretty hot, you know, over there. And it starts to warm up in Egypt right about now. It gets pretty warm in April. And so during the day, they had this shade, and it shaded them. But it says God was in there, and he did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. How many of you know how long that pillar of cloud during the day and fire at night actually was with them? You know, most of you. How many think it lasted 6 months? How many think it lasted a year? How many think it lasted 40 years? That pillar and cloud was with them day and night for 40 years. 40 years. Very impressive. And God was in that pillar. Did they ever see God actually directly? No. But they knew he was in the pillar. And elsewhere, and we won't go through those scriptures, God would sometimes just reveal himself in face to face or speech to speech to Moses. And they would have some kind of communication. I don't know how close Moses could get except for the one time in the mountain when he saw Moses' backside, remember? But apparently he didn't look. Although God used the phrase, I could speak to Moses face to face, but there must have been a bit of a veil there. So anyway, this presence of God was with them all the time. Now, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, because Egyptians get wind of this, they are bewildered by the land, and the wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart, so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. Apparently, with all this experience they'd gone through, they did not know that God was the Lord yet. Now, it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? What was in my head? What was I thinking? Did I have a bad hair day? Or don't I have any hair? What was I doing when I got up that morning and said, let the people go? Oh, what got into me? What were you thinking? Who are you, you advisors? What were you thinking? Why did we let these people go? What a ridiculous idea. Why, they were the foundation of our economy. They gave us wealth. They built our cities. Why would we let them go? What a stupid idea. Well, you might say Pharaoh had what would be called early onset. You know, any of you under 30, you wouldn't know what I mean by this. But if you're over 50. Do you, some of you besides me, kind of know what it's like to have memory lapses? Huh? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, this Pharaoh had a real memory lapse, and frankly, that's the nature of the carnal mind. Because when people are challenged and they are forced by God with no internal understanding of what he's doing or any appreciation for God spiritually, forced to do something, they immediately forget why they did it. It looks irrational. You see, Pharaoh never really did believe in the power that destroyed him, right? He didn't know what wrecked him. He just knew that he had no choice. Everybody was telling him his son had died, and he let him go, right? Well, there were 10 plagues. First, they had the blood in the river, right? Pretty nasty. It got to be real smelly. And apparently the blood came out of the pots, you know, right? And whatever they were trying to drink out of. So the water fountain at the Y or whatever. You know, there was blood everywhere. Well, that was nasty, and they got that stopped. And then they had the frogs. Did you go through this in any sermon this year, all the different plagues? It's good to kind of remind ourselves at the end, right? So they had the frogs. Now, frogs were everywhere. Frogs were, when you wanted a kiss, there was a frog, right? There was a frog in your bed. There was a frog in your bathroom. There, not a frog, but frogs everywhere. You'd go out to take a walk, and there were frogs under your feet. There were frogs in the stores. There were, you know, there were just frogs everywhere. There's frogs in the temples. There's frogs in the schools. Real slimy, awful. Okay? They killed the frogs. You know what happened next? Frogs stink. Bad. Real bad. The whole country just smelled like dead frogs. No, think of it. Pretty nasty. This would have been just as true for Pharaoh and his household. And, you know, they didn't get dirty, those guys. They had real pretty marble floors and everything was gold. And nobody could approach the Pharaoh because he was God on earth and so forth. This was real nasty for Pharaoh. Then they had the lice. And every place on your body was, you know, subject to being, you know, being bitten by these lice. And you'd scratch and, and this happened to Pharaoh too. And then you had the locusts, and they flew in and flew out and ate everything and got in your way, and it just came over a huge cloud. And then they had the fire on the ground, right? So it was like lightning on the ground. And the hail came down and ruined everything, and these cattle were dead. And then you had the darkness for 3 days, so that it says it could be felt, you know, so dark that apparently candles or whatever, you could just feel it just clammy, and you couldn't tell anybody was, you know. These were all supernatural, and they were also directed against the gods of Israel, or excuse me, of Egypt, because they worship the sun, they worship these animals, they worship the river. God was smashing all of their supposed powers that they worshipped and had all these ceremonies about. And then, of course, the firstborn were killed. So the fact that Pharaoh completely forgot shows you the capacity, and the Egyptians, the capacity for the human mind to simply get rid of any intervention by the real God, by Christ, in their mentality. It says here that the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And that was God's will, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness initially. They were real confident. So the Egyptians pursued them in the horses and the chariots and overtook them, camping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth before Baal-Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. Now, you know, traditionally, we in the Church of God have felt that the last day of unleavened bread was the time in which this occurred, maybe the night before. We don't really know for sure. It may not have been. But not too long after they left the land, this did occur. And it says, they were very afraid because the Egyptians marched after them, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Okay, here's the Red Sea. Here's the Egyptians. They're just a few days out of Egypt, and this is the situation. And I ask you, 2 or 3 million people, how long does it take to start to scream and yell and gossip and get in a horrible, nasty attitude? How long? Did this take, 3-4 days? They've got these guys kind of marching down here. It says they cried to the Lord. Well, how long did they give the Lord to respond, one way or another? Let's say a half hour on the outside. Probably more. How long does it take a family connected to another family and another and another and another and another, another, 2 or 3 million people to all gossip and get really scared? 15 minutes? 5, right. All right, well, this is pretty dramatic. Now, this is what the people said. First of all, they cried out toward the pillar, right? And this apparently is getting to be late afternoon or into the evening. So maybe the pillar was turning red for them already. They're starting to see the fire. I don't know. We can't see exactly what hour this was, but the next sequence all occurs within rather quick pace over a period of 12, 15 hours, it would appear. And so they give God a shot. They cry out to the Lord. What, 5, 10, 15 minutes, a half hour. Then they said to Moses. So they turn on Moses right away. Obviously, the pillar ain't going to do anything, right? Or it isn't. Getting the English right, the Hebrew right here. And it says, because there are no graves in Egypt. This is what their storyline is. This is this is where they're going rhetorically. This is their argument to Moses. Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you we needed? We told you we didn't kind of want to come out of here. We told you to leave us alone. We told you this is all going to be trouble. We told you you can't count on this God of yours. Saying, we told you, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. We had a better idea. Now look what you've gotten us into. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Now, the children of Israel were very imaginative. They had a wide range of options right before them. They were real big thinkers. We could have stayed in Egypt, or we could die. There's no other option here, right? They were very big thinkers. They had a lot on their mind in there. The natural, the human mind looks at things physically and doesn't even see the potential. Does it? Not when it's dealing with God. It's like here, all that experience that they've gone through and coming out, and they had all this gold with them, and all the hours and days that they had seen this pillar now leading them were nothing to them. They already knew God had said, I was going to save you. But they had completely forgotten the God that had been dealing with them the way God had already been working with them. So they didn't understand that what God was driving for was freedom. That's why he was bringing them out, to give them freedom, and that's what they were going toward, and all they had to do is to follow, not to blame, and give it a little while. And Moses said to the people, so this was a matter of minutes later, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. Now, did Moses know that that sea was going to open up at this point? Is there any indication that Moses knew that the sea was going to open up? No. He just knew enough about God. He'd been dealing with God now for some months, hadn't he? God had shown him the burning bush. God had given him the rod. God had performed all these miracles. He also apparently had been given God's Spirit at some point along the road here. So Moses was yielded. He was very humble. He had come to learn to trust. He did not know, apparently, that the sea was going to open. But he did know this. God hadn't brought them, because God had already told him, brought them there to kill him. He did know that. And he was pretty convinced based on the experiences that he'd already had, that God was going to take care of these Egyptians, who were not acting too bright at this point. God had told him consistently, I'm going to harden their hearts. God had hardened their hearts. Plague after plague after plague, God said, I'm going to harden his heart. He's going to come after. He's going to act real dumb here. And so Pharaoh was just acting according to script. And Moses had every confidence that God was going to fight for them. He could have done it in any number of ways. What ways? He could have had the hail come down. He could have had a locust bunch come and eat them up. Who knows? He could have put darkness over them so they couldn't see a thing. He could have killed them all like he did the firstborn, right? Just lay them dead there. So Moses had every confidence these people were not going to be a problem in another just little bit of time. But then God said to Moses, why do you cry to me? You know, like. So Moses was pretty urgent toward God. Tell the children of Israel to go forward. That's real logical, right? Just walk into the water. But lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. This is not going to be too smart. Not a smart move. So I will gain over Pharaoh and over his army, his chariots, and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gained honor over myself, over Pharaoh and his chariots and his horsemen. Now, brethren, we've got to understand the significance, ultimately, of this is written for us, as we'll see. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians 10. Because as we go through the story here and we consider the mentality of both the Egyptians and the Israelites, we're going to see that neither side understood what God was doing and the ultimate purpose. In 1 Corinthians 10, though, Paul, who was writing, and you may have covered this already in these days, Paul, who was writing to the Corinthians during the days of unleavened bread, I mean, this book was written for a church that had a lot of spiritual problems, and he was addressing them at the time of the Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread in this letter, 1 Corinthians. This is a book about the church's problems, and he's putting the context together in the background of God's dealing with Israel in this particular passage to show that many, many of the problems of the church were simply a reflection they didn't understand how God really is and was demonstrated in this coming out of Egypt. Verse 1 of chapter 10, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud. All passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud." Actually, they were like baptized as a result of this cloud. The cloud was over them, covered them, protected them, and without the cloud, they'd be dead. Without that presence and that protection, they were, as it were, it says, baptized, immersed in the cloud and in the sea. All were baptized and ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So it was Christ. It says the Lord was in the cloud. "But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted. Do not become idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell later on in a trial. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain, grumble, complain, tear the church apart through their grumbling and complaining, as some of them complained and were destroyed by the destroyer." What he's describing there is the tendencies in human nature. Just plain old people being what they are naturally. Let's consider the Israelites and how different they are than the Americans or even you or me. Because we're all Americans and whatever. We're human. Basically, they are, and they were, driven for security. What are the basic needs? They were very interested in security, weren't they? They were interested in making sure that they were alive, they had some kind of shelter, they had some kind of future, and unfortunately, they were willing to live in slavery, right? They were living in slavery before, and they were willing, for their security needs, to live in slavery. Now, was there real security there? You know, there was already a systematic genocide going on. Their children, the firstborn, were being systematically killed. That's how Moses came into existence. They were attempting to kill all the firstborn. They were systematically executing ethnic cleansing. They were having problems because they were getting pregnant so much they couldn't get the kids dead fast enough. A lot of them were getting through. But nonetheless, they had a plan to exterminate the race as it was. So there was really no security and freedom there, but that was one of their basic drives, and all people have that. They also had a desire, people do, to fulfill their minimum levels of pleasure. They liked to please themselves. All people do. God built a desire for pleasant things into the human being. But they really desired to fill them in the way they wanted. And so one of the other characteristics of the average person is they really don't want anyone telling them what they are to do. So in their case, the Egyptians probably had a systematic, it's very sad to consider, but a systematic way of going in and sexually perverting the race. There was probably sexual abuse, always was. The Middle East is rampant with it now. Did you know that? Did you know that bisexuality is the majority practice of Arab men? Did you know that? Did you know that in most Arab societies that are traditional across the board, if a woman has any sexual involvement prior to marriage, she is killed? Did you know that? Anyway, there's a reason why the Bible calls that part of the Middle East, even Jerusalem at the very end, Sodom and Egypt, for the Palestinian population there. So, common to the Israelites were traits and characteristics of Egypt in their own patterns of behavior. They worshipped, from all we can see in other scriptures, they worshipped the Egyptian gods. They knew nothing of the true God. And so they, too, like most people everywhere, want to basically be in charge and in control of the way they want to define reality and what they're going to do about it. And they want life basically on their own terms. Right? Well, it's no different than people today. What we see here, though, in chapter 10, Paul's interpreting it to the church, this experience, when these people were idolaters, they were sexually immoral, they tempted Christ, they complained and griped about any number of things, God and the leadership and what he was doing to bring them into freedom. In verse 11, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come. So all these things are really given to us so we can analyze our approach and our behavior so we don't make the mistakes, because in attaining real freedom, we've got to be a completely different people in our approach. It says, therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Now, let's go back. Oh, no, there's of course, verse 13, which is the creme de creme, you might say. No temptation, no trial, brethren. When you go out of here tomorrow or tonight and you have your first, you know what? Right at sundown. Are you going to take, any of you tonight going to eat bread right after sundown? Beside this honest young man. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I don't know who I'm going to eat with, but... oh, by the way, it was asked in the sermon at time up in Tri-Cities, down in Tri-Cities, did anybody find any leavening in places they didn't know, that really didn't plan on it? Did you find any surprises in your houses at all? You don't have to raise your hand, but I'll raise mine. You know what? I was cleaning yesterday. I wasn't home. I'd cleaned all my stuff up, I thought, before, but I was cleaning a little bit in the living room, and in this hutch we have, my 11-year-old, long ago apparently, had stuck a whole box of goldfish. We had so much sin in our living room all week. No, it's a symbol of sin. But you're going to find that. You're going to find a box here and there. And you know what? I bet when it comes to spirituality, there are boxes of leavening in your character you didn't even get to, you didn't even see during this Days of Unleavened Bread. Is that possible? Sure is with me. I just get a little bit, during this season, I get a little bit of a look at what I'm really like, and through the years, I'm learning to trust the fact that if I don't close the door after, and I look at it more and I ask God for help, that's good. This is just an opening. It's kind of an awareness, this ritual, and I'm so glad that God gives us this, and I don't mean ritual in a vain way, this experience where we're reminded, aren't you? Because it opens your mind to the spiritual. Now, It does say no temptation is has overtaken, no trial except as such is common to man. All the trials that you go through basically in life, people go through them. They're up against the wall sometimes, but there's a difference. God is faithful. As we go through the rest of the story, we're going to see that what God wants you to understand is you're not dealing with a natural God. The head of the church of God, your head, the one that has guided you to be here, is not natural. My God, your God, our head of this church is totally supernatural. Now, a lot of us can come to church and we do these things year after year, and we think we're sort of like everybody else that has their religion. Not so. We didn't make this religion up. We received it. We didn't make up the rules of what we're supposed to do, or when we don't generate the power within ourselves that takes us through these experiences and this spiritual growth. Our God is faithful, and He is supernatural. And He intervenes, and He empowers, He opens, and He shuts. And it is His power that will determine our success. And it is there. See, you're going to be tempted, and I'm tempted, and we all are, in the sense that we're tried. We also have human nature that we got to put down. But we have a power in us that is not human if we have that Holy Spirit. This teaching is supernatural in origin, this whole book. It's written from another point of view that you're not going to find on the earth. It comes from out there, actually, from the third heaven. And so we need to understand that though we will have trials like other people, God is faithful. Was He faithful to Israel? Was any other people on the face of the earth to that time and since in a position where their enemies were literally going to wipe them out? Yes. And were they wiped out? In many cases, yes. Right? There's been genocides before, or whole peoples wiped out. But God is different. For His people, He's not going to let His people that are faithful get wiped out. He just won't. It says, who will not allow you to be tempted or tried beyond what you are able, but with the temptation, will also make a way of escape. And that's what we're talking about. There is a way out, and God will lead you to it, that you may be able to bear it. And so let's remember that these examples, we go back here and we see what happened back in Exodus. These examples are really to show us that God is for us and supernatural. This is not a natural thing. And this experience that they went through, brethren, this experience of coming out of Israel, or excuse me, coming out of Egypt through the 10 plagues and the Red Sea, is the greatest supernatural intervention in world history. You understand this? Every year we are recounting this because it is the greatest intervention in world history. We had the flood, and the flood did not save, did it? The flood wiped the whole human race out, save a few people. Except for the miracle of Jesus Christ's resurrection, this is the greatest intervention in all of human history, and in terms of national scale and the shaping of history in terms of this world, it's even greater in terms of what happened to the nations than anything else. And this is true until the second coming of Christ. There will be no intervention by God any greater than this until Jesus Christ returns. Because even our own nation, we sitting here, most of us, all of us, the way we live, whatever our ethnic background, we're as a result of this miracle. We're even here. Our forefathers went through an experience, so it made it possible for you and I to be here. So when we're going through this, this is the scale and the scope of what we're observing. It says here back in Exodus 14 then, when God had said, the Egyptians shall know that I'm the Lord after the children of Israel go through the sea, in verse 19, and the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. Now, another word, name for Christ is angel, messenger. Remember, Jacob wrestled all night. Remember, he did with the angel of God, and it was later said that he actually wrestled with God. Another term for Christ is angel, who went before the camp, moved, and went behind them. And the pillar of the cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So the pillar was in front of the children of Israel, right next to the sea, and it moved around and stood between the Egyptians and themselves. It actually went around the entire camp. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. Now consider, there's meaning in here, and there's symbolism. People who, like the Egyptians, look into the presence of God and where God is working, all they can see is blank. It's dark. They can't see through to any light. They can't see past what God has put up. He's put up a screen, and the world cannot see through that screen. You hear the president, these cardinals over 2-3 weeks ago, and the president is bowing there in the Vatican. And they're all of them saying prayers to John Paul II, you know, and his soul, which is supposedly in heaven. There is a blank wall. It's like a dark cloud between the people of this world who are religious and think they really believe in God and what God really has for mankind. They cannot see past that thick darkness. And yet they have this same book that we read out of. And yet at the same time, it gave light to the Israelites. So God's people can look at the same power and they get light. We can look at what Jesus Christ is doing, and it gives us hope. It actually gives us light. We have a sense of perspective. It's there all the time for us. We're never without God. And so it says, then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on the right hand and on the left. Now, you've probably heard various speculations about where this may have occurred in the Sinai area. Well, it does appear it is down by the water and not up toward the north, so that they were led relatively quickly down next to the water. Some think it should be on this or that side of the Gulf of Eilat. But what we do know is that these people went over in an area that apparently was miles and miles long, and virtually all the areas of the Red Sea that you find to cross have pretty deep parts to it. So we're talking that these walls of water were hundreds of feet high. And apparently it was like a big vacuum cleaner blowing the other way in order to open this thing up. What that sounded like, and this is at night, And the Egyptians couldn't see, but they could see, and the pillar of fire was apparently bright enough that they could go forward because this was still dark. Of course, this was during the Passover moon time, right? Days of Unleavened Bread still, so that big moon is still up there. So they could see somewhat. But with a wall, with fish looking through, like an aquarium with no glass, and I don't know if you could see, but it had to be pretty terrifying. Don't you think? Some of you were, a lot of you, of course, have been baptized, most of you. And when you went in there, you kind of wondered, people would say, now, how long is he going to keep me down there? You know, what do you mean I'm going to die in there? So these people were pretty terrified, and they really didn't have any choice. And here's another reason why. Says that the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were the wall to them in the right hand, and the Egyptians pursued after them. But you have to realize, it appears that as they went through, the pillar of fire was in the water with them. Did you know that? That the pillar of fire apparently separated them and marched along with them. And not until I got into reading this over and over again, I said, well, wow, I never saw that before. But it had to be, otherwise they wouldn't be separated, right? And then notice this. The Egyptians pursued and went after them in the midst of the sea. Now it came to pass in the morning watch, so this had been going on hour after hour after hour, and it's starting to be dawn pretty quick, that the Lord looked down. So here he is in the middle of it. And it says he looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud. So God was right there, and he looked back down, and he said, I'm going to fix their wheels. And troubled the army of the Egyptians, and he took off their chariot wheels. So they drove them with difficulty. I guess so. Now, Moses wrote this 40 years later. You know, I wonder if he ever had a chuckle. I don't know. He'd been through a lot, and I don't know how much humor he had left after all this. But so it says, he took off their chariot wheels, and the Egyptian said, let us flee from the face of Israel. Duh. For the Egyptians fight for them against the Egyptians, or the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. And then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, and the waters may come back upon the Egyptians and on the chariots and on their horsemen. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. It must have been a terrifying, weird thing. It was almost, they were seized by this stupidity, and all of a sudden, oh, this is it. Sort of like the Titanic. How many of you watched that movie years and years ago? That was pretty good, wasn't it? It was terrible, but it was well done. It really is quite terrifying. I know teenage girls really liked that movie for some reason at the time. I had a daughter that just made posters of it. She got more special credits out of about 2 years of showing her little boards about the ship and it going down and everything. She was just fascinated. Well, this is the kind of a story that is, brethren, so overworked. And I think in the environment of Hollywood's overuse and misuse of special effects, the edge is lost. Because you have to realize there are no miracles except God's and the devil's. And the God grants the devil occasionally to perform something. But all these special effects that Hollywood's coming up with, they're all fake. And we have a generation of people who really think that all these special effects are maybe kind of real. They're not. This book is full of supernatural effects of God, and He's the only one that can do them. We live in a generation that cannot really perceive reality. So they read the Bible almost as if it was composed by Hollywood. But we, brethren, should appreciate this is real. But unless we have the right attitude and the right spirit, it will have no more effect than it did on the Israelites, because here they were going through it, and did they really think it was real? No. They had the pillar and the cloud there. Did they really believe it? No. There is a psalm that summarizes this whole experience. And I think we should go through this psalm, because as a result of this psalm, Paul used the example of the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. In the Psalm 78, it actually commands that we are supposed to remember this occasion if we are followers of God, no matter what generation, because it truly is the biggest event in world history, saving a people, a divine intervention. Psalm 78, verse 1, give ear, O my people, to my law. The law there is Torah, or teaching. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old. Now, what is a parable, brethren, to the world? A parable is a story that comes from God that the world does not understand its significance and where it leads. Jesus said that about parables, right? That the world cannot understand it. What is a parable to the people of God? It is a story that, when you consider it back and forth, will explain how God is dealing with His people to lead them into the kingdom of God. That's what this experience that this psalm is pointing to is supposed to do for God's people. Show how God is leading them for all time. It says, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us, we will not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and His strength and His wonderful works that He has done. For He has established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which He commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children. So this storyline that we've been going through is actually commanded. It must be taught among the people of God to the next generation. It must be. It's a commandment. The parents and the teachers in the church are all supposed to make sure the children understand this is not Hollywood fiction. This is not a bedtime story. This is real. This happened. And what's the reason? That the generation to come might know the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children. And this is the purpose, that they may set their hope in God. That our young people, and that you with them, should be able to believe God and have hope that He is going to take you through. He's going to save you. He's going to take care of you. He's going to give you freedom. He's going to take you through the process and give you eternal life. He's going to bring you to that promised land. That's why we go through this story, and it actually says it's a commanded thing. And not to forget the works of God. God will work, He does intervene, but keep His commandments too, everything He says to do. And may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright and whose spirit was not faithful to God. Verse 10, they did not keep the covenant of God, and they refused to walk in His teaching, His law, and forgot His works and His wonders that He had shown them. Brethren, when God took them through the sea and on the other side, He was preparing them to learn a new way, not of Egypt, but a new way of life that would be an eternal life, eventually, that would give them success in every way, but it meant that they had to leave that culture and they actually had to leave what it represented inside them. You've heard ministers say for years and years during this period of time, they could come out of Egypt, and they came out of Egypt, but Egypt never came out of them, right? They were internally like the Egyptians, right? What was their greatest problem? Well, we'll see. They forgot His works and His wonders that they had that He had shown them, just like Pharaoh had done. Marvelous things He did in the sight of their fathers in the land of Egypt, in the field of Zoan. He divided the sea and caused them to pass through, and He made the waters stand up like a heap. In the daytime also He led them with the cloud, and all the night with the light of the fire. See? This is what He wants us to remember. 40 years, the pillar was there. And it was actually a pillar of freedom. If you looked at it, and you understood it at the time, if you were smart, you could look it over there and say, that's my freedom. That's my ticket. That's who I'm following into freedom. Everything God then told them to do, He brought them down to Sinai and gave them the law. It was all about a new way of life of freedom. The opposite of the ways of Egypt. It says He split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink in abundance like the depths. He also brought streams out of the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. But they sinned even more against Him. And what was the nature of their sin? By rebelling against the Most High in the wilderness. And they tested God in their heart. This is it. In their hearts, they attributed to the God in the fire and in the cloud the same motives of Pharaoh. Think of it. They saw the miracles. They did all this. They came out, and every chance they had to make a decision of whether they're going to believe God or not, they attributed the same motive, genocide, to God, to Christ in the cloud and in the pillar, that actually was the intent of Pharaoh. Now, is that a good attitude? We have to watch it. All of us really have to watch it. Because the God that's dealing with us and who has opened our minds to understand all of this, He wants you to know He's really different. But He expects us to really believe Him. But they sinned even more against Him by rebelling. And then they asked food for their fancy. Yes, they spoke against God and they said, can God prepare a table in the wilderness? They got to the point, after seeing all of this, they got hungry. And then they said, well, I wonder if He would know how to feed us. Really? God could do all of this, and I wonder if He's smart enough to know how to feed me. Can He prepare a table for us in the wilderness? And then it says, He gave the waters gushing out, streams overflow. And then they said, can He give us bread? I mean, give us a little bread. See if you could sort of jump through my hoops. Are we talking a stinking attitude here? As bad as those dead frogs? And can He provide meat for His people? Is He that smart? Therefore, the Lord heard this and was furious. So a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger also came out against Israel. Why? Because they did not believe in God. And they didn't trust in His salvation, that His whole intent was to free them, give them a wonderful life. It was their rotten attitude that was their sin. It was the foundation of it, their sin. Why was Christ, and it was Christ, why was He so furious? You know, the world presents Jesus as meek and mild and, you know, so forth. Yeah, He would throw tables over, but be so angry with the nation of Israel that He would wipe them out, almost, being so furious with them? Doesn't show a Christ. The world doesn't know Christ has that side of Him. Why was He so furious? Well, the reason is because the God and Christ inside that pillar and cloud was the same one that died on the Passover. And He was doing nothing but good. And He knew He was going to die one day for them, for the Egyptians, for everyone. And these were a people that were going to represent Him for the whole world, and through whom He was eventually going to be born. And He was going to die and drip His blood and go through incredible pain for a people who treated Him as if His motives were the same as the devil's. And that really made Him mad. That's why He was furious. And even with this fury, the rest of this psalm, which we're not going to read, goes through time and time again. For 700 years, Christ was patient with these people who never believed Him and what He's going to do, and killed His prophets that talked about His love constantly. And so it says in verse 24, He rained down manna on them to eat. He commanded the clouds above, and He gave them the bread of heaven. Men ate angels' food. He sent them food to the full. He caused an east wind to blow in the heavens. Here, another wind. And by His power, He brought in the south wind. And He rained meat on them like the dust, feathered fowl like the sand of the seas. And He let them fall in the midst of the camp all around their dwellings. Now, it's interesting. You go a few chapters up. You know the day that the manna started? Did you know that's the day that quail came too? The manna in the morning, they had to take that stuff up, and they called it, what is it, you know, the story, and it was sweet. And they never had anything like it. But by the way, those of you into health foods, you know, you get the patent on that. And I'll tell you, you'd have a really good food. You know, perfect protein balance and all that stuff. I bet it would fix your DNA. You'd live to be who knows how long. But anyway, that's my theory about manna. But He fed them. But, you know, in the nighttime, that's when He dropped the quail. And it said it was fancy food. Now, a lot of us have had this idea that what they did is they just got these quail with all the feathers and everything, and they just started clomping on it and eating them with feathers. And that's what made God mad, because they were eating with the feathers. I mean, I've heard various theories. Haven't you? Have you ever heard theories? I don't think so. It says He gave them fancy food. Now, this is my speculation, and don't write the Home Office. You know, they'll say, oh, no, not a Howard speculation again. They'll say, don't waste your time. But I think that these were plucked and glazed, and it had duck larange all over them, the sauce. And it was so sweet and perfect. But it says it came down. Maybe they were pre-cooked perfectly. Maybe. You know, with a little garnish, you know, whatever. I don't know. But anyway, it says He gave them, it was wonderful, whatever. And there's their attitude. He gave them their own desire, and I don't think that was a mouthful of feathers. They were not deprived of their craving. But while their food was still in their mouths, the wrath of God came upon them and slew the stoutest of them and struck down the choice men, these big, handsome hunks. Right there, they're just eating their quail, and they just die. And why was that? Well, let's face it. It's because they didn't even turn their heads. They didn't have a heart of thankfulness. They didn't realize the glory of what was going on, just the sheer miraculous power. God was doing everything. He was air conditioning them by day. At night, you know, it gets very cold in the desert, truly, in April, May, June. Even, you know, it gets very cold out there. They had a pillar of fire there. And who knows, maybe they did a little draft went over and maybe warmed the whole place up, just the perfect nighttime temperature. Why not? He did everything to show them how gentle, how loving. He never wanted them to go to war. It's because they had war in their heart. He went ahead and let them. God wanted to give his people freedom, and he did. He wants the same thing for us, brethren. But unless we understand who's inside the pillar and that cloud, and we have our hearts oriented, especially for the purpose that he's leading, then we'll never have any more understanding than they did. What does he want? He wants you and me to have, as I hear that you already had a sermon this morning, he wants you to have the divine nature, the character that he has inside you through the Holy Spirit. Inside that pillar was Christ in his glory. Nobody could see it. But inside Christ is the nature of God, both him and the Father. And that Holy Spirit is that very divine nature. And he's put it in you, and he's put it in me. In 1 Corinthians 5, again, a book all about the Days of Unleavened Bread and its lessons, Paul summed up why we keep these days. He said, verse 7, 1 Corinthians 5, therefore purge out the old leaven. What is that? It's cynicism. It's malice. It's a competitive, I'm better than you are. It's not caring. It's not love. Purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump. Since you truly are unleavened, if you are converted, if you have gone under that cloud and you have been through the sea, as it were, if you truly have given up what it means to just be motivated by the things of this world and its flesh. It says, purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, for you truly are unleavened, for indeed Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, and this is the leaven, not with the leaven of malice and wickedness. It means an evil intent to hurt before you are hurt. See, the reason the Israelites had that attitude is they had been abused since childhood with lies, with slavery. We probably saw there was probably tremendous frustration in the families, and there probably was abuse throughout the society in every way imaginable. And so malice was in there, because they were a part of the world, and what the world does, it hurts, and then it teaches you to hurt. Teaches people to hurt. They become so callous and cynical. All they care about is themselves, their own egos. We are not to be that way with the old leaven of malice and wickedness. And the word wickedness here means out of the way. It also can mean slippery, slick, and crooked. it means a crooked way. It's not straight. It's not true. And that applies to virtually everything man does. Not with the unleavened bread, or not with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. When we consider the pillar and the cloud, what God was looking for is to bring a people out who would learn a way all based on sincerity, 100% dedicated to the God, our God, in the cloud and the pillar. Whatever he said goes, because his only intent is love and is freedom. To have the same spirit as the God in the cloud and the pillar. To have the same nature and future all tied up forever. That's what God wanted. And it says also truth. To live for truth. Jesus in John 14, you read this the other night. Jesus said this to Thomas, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. You're not going to get to God except through the God in the pillar and the cloud. We've got to realize that Christ's ways, when he said, be a peacemaker, when he said those things on the Sermon on the Mount, become like your perfect like your Father in heaven, when he said, seek you first the kingdom of God and his righteousness and everything will be added to you, when he said to have those beautiful attitudes of being a peacemaker and merciful and hungering and thirsting for righteousness, when he said, do those things, let those things consume your life, motivate you with zeal, and God's Spirit fill you. That's the way. That's the truth. That's Christ. That's who's in the pillar and the cloud. If we follow God past these days of unleavened bread with this sincerity, 100% and truth, we'll be in that kingdom. You have a great Sabbath.